Welcome tonight to Citizens Climate University. I'm your host, Brett Cease, and this is a weekly webinar program of Citizens Climate Lobbies that provides CCL supporters like you and I with access to in-depth training opportunities on topics relating to climate change and effective climate advocacy. Tonight, we're very lucky to have Dr. Danny Richter join us, CCL's Vice President of Government Affairs, in a webinar exploring the detailed hows and whys of the dividend delivery study. And without further ado, let me introduce our esteemed guest. So Dr. Danny Richter is CCL's Vice President of Government Affairs. Dr. Richter joined CCL staff in 2013 after 5 years as a volunteer, completing his PhD in oceanography at Scripps while getting paid to do scientific research on all seven continents. So if you have any questions at the end about any of those continental explorations, I'm sure Danny would love to speak to that too. As CCL's first staffer in D.C., he established our D.C. office, where he's been responsible for developing our overall legislative strategy and clarifying the details of our policy on the Hill and interacting with other groups throughout Washington. He's also overseen CCL's research program, which has led directly to our REMI study, the Household Impact Study, and tonight's topic du jour, the Dividend Delivery Study. So a quick reminder of the learning goals tonight. They're threefold. We're hoping that attendees after listening will be able to understand the details behind the carbon fund and distributional framework that's needed to administer the dividend. We're hoping to also really highlight the key findings from that study, the dividend distribution study. And finally, we also hope that all volunteers would be more prepared to field questions about the taxability of the dividend and other more advanced topics you might encounter in the field related to the pathway of returning the revenue to households. So without further ado, here's the agenda, and I'll get out of the way. We're going to talk about the carbon fund details and then the dividend distribution study in itself. Danny will then talk about the taxability and other issues that have come up with questions in advance. We'll clarify some things from the conference presentations on this topic, and the rest of the night will be devoted to active Q&A. So without further ado, we welcome you, Danny. Thanks so much for making time tonight, and the floor is yours.
All right. Thank you very much, Brett, and thank you to everybody who's on the line. So let's go through the dividend delivery study, and let's start with some details of the carbon fund. So our policy would create a separate trust fund, and this would be the destination of all carbon fees raised domestically and on fossil fuels at the border. The border adjustment would be into a separate pot of money. This would be established by statute as a standalone account, which cannot be rated for general revenue. The only purpose of this would be to pay out dividends, and this fund would not grow government. It's just there. So that is the carbon fund from which all dividends are to be paid. Now, just as a reminder, for eligibility, adults age 19 and up get a full share, and dependent minors up to age 19 get a half share, and a maximum of two dependent minors per household are eligible for shares, and any U.S. resident with a social security number or individual tax identification number, ITIN, qualifies. Our goal here is to get it to as many people as possible. So that's the distributional framework. Don't need to spend too much time on that. And so distributing the dividend. So this is about a study we had done, the dividend delivery study. And here you can see the first page and the start of the table of contents. The full report is now available on our website. And if you go to our website, you go to the very bottom, you look up dividend delivery study, you will get this report. Now, why did we do this report? The original work was done. This is a 2016 study. After our June 2015 analysis, so this is after the 500 meetings or so that we had in June of 2015, I was reading through those notes, as I always do, and I noticed that the dividend was the number one issue that offices wanted to know more about. We were being asked questions, and we needed more in-depth information to provide to these interested offices. And so I thought, if we're going to really be responsive to the needs of members of Congress, if we're going to be good lobbyists here, we really need more in-depth answers than we have right now. So that's why we did the original 2016 study. After that study, we made a summary available and we made a 10-page FAQ available. We did have the full report, but that was really only shared with congressional offices. And I came to realize that that was a mistake. It was a mistake not to share the full study with the volunteers. We weren't getting as many people sharing it, and as many questions from offices. And so I wanted to do a 2018 update. So that update came out just before the conference. It cleaned up the 2016 report to make sure it was ready for public consumption. And it was also done to reflect the current politics to make sure that the recent tax reform law, which passed, didn't have any effect on the conclusions of that report, or at least that those effects that they would have were accounted for and adjustments were made. So that's why we have the 2018 update, and that's what I'll be presenting on tonight. So what were staffers asking? The main thing that they were asking our volunteers back in that 2015 analysis, and it has been a top four issue in each of the years that I've done an analysis of the June notes. This is a persistent topic that members of Congress and their staff bring up, and usually they are asking questions. They don't even think this is possible. So the situation was that our volunteers were going in there saying, yes, this is possible, and staffers weren't buying it. So maybe they would say, okay, maybe this is possible, but they would want to know how. And the explanation that we were giving was completely inadequate. It was just completely inadequate. We were saying something along the lines of, well, we can go through Social Security. That already gets revenue out to millions of Americans, does so at low cost, and they just weren't buying it. So the main things that we wanted to answer were, is this possible and how? And they wanted the nitty-gritty details. So does this report answer these questions? Yes, it does. It answers both of those. It gets into those nitty-gritty details, and so much so that it, in fact, answers questions they didn't even know that they had. So that's a bonus. And part of that is because of the person who did the report. So the person who we got to do the report is Alan H. Lerman. He is a retired economist from the United States Treasury's Department of Tax Analysis. And he worked on every major tax reform legislation and administrative reform from 1971 to 2014. Some other highlights from his resume is he developed tax withholding forms. So when you tell the government you want to have this much tax withheld in the form you fill out, that was him. The stimulus checks we all got in 2008 and 2009, that was him. He figured out how to do that. So when finding out someone to get, how do you figure out to get all this money to every American, as many Americans, people living in the United States as possible, there really is nobody better. And it was fortunate for us that he had retired the year before we identified this concern, this persistent and frequently mentioned concern and question by members of Congress, which we were unable to answer. And of course, CCL depends on outside experts for guidance on complex questions of policy and law. He is exceptionally qualified. And the other thing I'll say about my role as the person who oversees our research program, I see it as my role to give the researchers we commission freedom. I want them to do what they do best. I want to make sure that their research is going to answer the questions we need to be answered. So I tell them, spend a lot of time working with them about what the constraints are, but I don't spend a lot of time telling them how to write the report. And I don't tell them how to do the research. I think that gives the report integrity. So that's another thing to bear in mind is that I make sure they get our program as close as possible, but I don't tell them how to do the research. So that's just something I bring. And it is to retain as much credibility for the final product as possible. So our priorities, some of the things that I was presenting to Alan as needing to do, number one, we want something that is as simple as possible because we want the public to understand it. We want to be able to sell it. We want this to get to as many people as possible. People living in the United States, not just citizens, people resident in the United States, we want it to get to as many people as possible. And we want this to be as low cost. We want the administrative cost to be as low as possible. But the top priorities are simplicity, getting to as many people as possible. And then we do want to have low cost is third. So there are some costs. Now, another thing that you'll notice in this study, and this is something that people were concerned about. Alan did consider what would happen if you did this as a tax swap, specifically a payroll tax swap. And the reason he did that was because he thought that would be the most efficient. And the reason I let him do that is because, as I said, I think it's important to enable our researchers to have independence, because I think that gives the report more intellectual integrity. And so Alan went through, he did evaluate both a dividend, just monthly checks, and he did evaluate getting the money back to people by reducing payroll tax offsets. That was never what was going to be our policy, but it was something that he thought would be simpler. And it's something that, speaking to people on the Hill, people on the Ways and Means Committee, people on the Finance Committee, is their baseline assumption of what will be simpler as well. But after doing this, after considering these two methods, Alan's conclusion was that actually the direct monthly payment system is best. It's simpler, it's more flexible. It does require a little bit more time to implement, but ultimately it is going to be lower costs for the government. There are going to be fewer errors. You're going to be able to get to more people. So that was a evolution that Alan went through as he was doing this. I feel really good about having it in the report because now we can go to offices and say, no, the author's assumption was the same as yours, that it would be easier to go through the payroll tax system. And he concluded that he was wrong. And some of the reasons, the main reasons why he concluded that was incorrect is because, number one, not everybody works in the United States. So for those people who don't work in the United States, you're still going to need to set up all the things you do for the dividend delivery system via direct checks. So then you're creating redundant bureaucracy. There was no way to check some of the withdrawals. So there was a quality control problem. And it got to the point, because our rate of increase is so aggressive with respect to the climate goals, you get to amounts of the dividend fairly quickly that are too large to handle for a lot of people, low-income folks or people with half-time jobs. And so you might have a situation where employers are having to take direct unverified withdrawals from the Carbon Dividends Trust Fund. And obviously that's a possibility for a lot of fraud. So the strong conclusion of this report is that the best way to do this is the way CCL has always been saying, which is through direct monthly dividends. And that was a misconception that some people left Alan's report with. And so I'm happy to clear it up here. So that's how to distribute the dividends. And then as you're going through this, one of the big things, I've read this report in its various iterations, possibly 30 times in detail, looking for spelling mistakes and typos, all that good stuff, as well as the larger content. And one of the things I was looking for was helping Alan figure out, how do we present this to the general public? How do we present this to CCL volunteers? Because let me tell you, Alan can get really nerdy. Now, I can get really nerdy as well, but his is a very different type of nerd. And so it took me a long time. It was really a pain to read through this thing. But ultimately, Alan identified the steps, and then I condensed. There are 10 total steps that are possible, from collecting the revenue to everybody gaining their dividends. And of those, either 2 or 4, it would only be 4 steps if there are mistakes, that would be necessary to be taken by residents, so by people receiving the dividend. The other six steps would be taken by agencies, and I'll talk about those in a bit. So the first step is to provide essential information. So that's names, social security numbers, or individual tax identification numbers, addresses, and bank account information. The second essential step, and this I don't think will be a burden for most people, is to actually receive the dividend. So step one, provide the information. Step two, receive the dividend. The potential other two steps would be if there are mistakes, to correct those mistakes. And then once those have been corrected, the fourth step is to receive the reconciliation payment. So in those maximum four steps by residents of the United States, two of them involve receiving dividends. So we were really spelling everything out in excruciating detail. There are six steps by agencies, and Alan developed a flow chart to do this. We've reproduced it here and changed it. The green boxes here are all the steps that might have to be taken by residents. And because we put such an emphasis on having everybody, as many people as possible, getting the dividend, and because Alan has such experience doing that, he identified those who are tax filers and those who are non-filers. And non-filers are generally going to be those who don't make enough money to need to file federal income taxes. And so it's basically the bottom 20%. And so tax filers are already providing the necessary information, the names, the social security numbers or individual tax identification numbers, the address and bank account information on their tax returns. No reason to make them do that again. Non-filers are not. And so Alan actually created, using a form, which he called CFD for Carbon Fee and Dividend 1, and I'll show you that to you in a minute, a form that is as simple as possible. It's only one page to help these non-filers claim their dividend. So it's, Alan learned in his long experience in the Treasury and his experience getting these dividends out to everybody, that you really do have to be as very simple to make sure that, to help people overcome their fear of reporting to the IRS. And so this would go to a contractor. His recommendation is that it doesn't go to the Social Security Administration or to the IRS or to a new organization, but it goes to a contractor. And so that way you hopefully take out some of the concern about reporting to the IRS. You also take out some of the political concerns about creating a new agency or sending this to the IRS. So go to the contractor. You can't cut the IRS out entirely. Again, because we're trying to keep this as simple and low cost as possible, it makes the most sense for those who are filing tax returns for the IRS to just share those data with the pay agent ultimately. So the IRS processes these forms, they merge the information, they extract and send the required information to Contractor B. Now, Contractor B could be the same as Contractor A, it just depends on the way Congress wants to do this. And Contractor B processes this information, they handle inquiries, so the inquiries will be related if there is a mistake, changes and corrections, and they determine the paying amounts, prepare a list and send to a pay agent. The pay agent could either be the Treasury Department or it could be another contractor. So some of these steps could be combined. They receive the payments list and they disperse the payments mainly by EFT, electronic funds transfer. Now over to the right, there's another green box. Residents initiate inquiries, changes in eligibility and error corrections. The responsibility would be on the residents if they, for example, if there's a birth, if there's a death, if somebody turns 19, if they become financially independent and they start filling out their own forms, it's on them to let the government know. And if they don't let the government know on time, they would be eligible for the dividend that they, the back payment. They just need to let them know. And so then residents receive their monthly payments. And at the end of the year, if there was a mistake, if they are owed more money, they prepare an annual reconciliation form on another form that Alan prepared, again, which is compatible with the IRS software, Carbon Fee and Dividend 5. Tax filers submit this with their income tax return. Non-filers submit it to Contractor A, and that's it. And then the IRS or Contractor A. They process these reconciliation forms. They prepare a list of adjustments, the authorized payments, and send the list to the pay agent. Pay agent receives it, disperses the adjustment, and then residents receive reconciliation payments. So again, there's a minimum of two, a maximum of four steps that residents see. The rest is that you can't pull the IRS out of this, but you need as few as two, the IRS and a contractor, or as many as four different agencies who would be involved in this process. And so 10 total steps, tax filers and non-filers. Seems complicated, but when you get right down to it, a lot of those steps are just receiving money. So again, the four options considered: the Internal Revenue Service, the Social Security Administration, a new agency within the Treasury Department, or private contractors working with the Treasury. And Alan's recommendation in the report is that option four would be the most efficient and politically viable, but you can't remove the IRS. They would still be necessary unless you want to create the annoyance of having people submit the same information to both the IRS and to a separate agency. So IRS is going to have to be involved. Now, who receives the money? For income tax filers, the primary tax filer receives the dividend for the self, up to two dependent children, and a spouse if they're filing jointly. Married couples filing separately can claim only one dependent child, and this is just to ensure that all actual households, and the household definition of household is the tax filing household, that they're not finding a loophole by which they could get four dividends for minors, just to make sure that we stay with the CCL formula: two shares per adult, one half share per child, up to two children per household. And other adults 19 and over who file their own taxes receive their own dividends. And you might be asking, why 19 and why not 18? It turns out that, according to Alan, it actually creates less headache for the existing infrastructure if you use 19 as the cutoff date. And since one of our goals was to minimize wasteful spending to maximize simplicity, we said, that's fine. Let's just go with what makes sense within the existing network. So we said 19. For nine non-filers, they must apply via CFD1. And I promised to show that to you. So let's show you what CFD1 looks like. This is it. And I love these. So these are all in the report, and they're just so similar to IRS forms. And I'll tell you a story. I was showing this to a committee staffer on the Finance Committee in the Senate. And this committee staffer had actually written a thesis on carbon taxes. And so this is somebody who day in, day out thinks about taxes and the tax code and how to change it. And as he was reviewing this report, the first one, he held these forms in his hand and he says, you know, it feels more real when you hold it in your hand and when you look at this. And so I've had really only good experiences sharing this report with offices. They see this report and they know, going back to the questions that they had, they know that we've thought through this in great depth. They see this and they see how quickly they could just plug this form in to the existing IRS software and it works. So this has been extremely effective, I found, in my lobbying, educating people who do this for a living to get them further on board. So this has been an extremely useful tool for CCL. So that's why I'm excited that I was able to correct my earlier error, and now it is shared with the entire organization, ready for you to download. So now, determining how much everybody gets. This is always good to check in with. And so these are Alan's numbers. He was basing this off of the REMI study, accounting for the taxability of the dividend. The first important thing is to recognize that the national amount collected will be an estimate. So the government is going to have to estimate how much money they're going to receive in a year to start giving out those monthly dividends. And so that's important. And so the dividend would be about $20 a month per adult and $10 per month per eligible child. And that's about $240 per adult and $120 per child annually. And the dividend would increase each year as the fee increased. So let's say, for example, that the estimate was too high. So they paid out more money than they received. And next year, they would actually have to correct for that. They'd have to give out less money than they were estimating would be raised to account for that overspending in that first year. That's okay. Everybody would still see an increased dividend because we're going up by so much each year. There's so much more money raised that people are going to see their dividend increase every year as long as for the foreseeable future, because we're increasing at such a aggressive rate. So the government can correct without increasing the deficit. People can still see their dividends go up. Everything should be peachy. Now, after 20 years, based on the Ramey study, the monthly dividend would be about $130 per adult per month and $65 per child. And that is over $1,500 per adult and $750 per child annually. So those are the numbers that Alan estimates, again, after accounting for the taxability of the dividend. And here is the CFD4, the carbon fee and dividend withholding certificate. Now, remember, I told you that Alan was the one who developed withholding certificates in the first place. So this is the W-4 forms that we all fill out when you get a job or when you get a raise. It just changes how much the federal government keeps out of your payroll. And so to avoid underpayment of tax, since the dividend is taxable, Alan created another one of these forms for this, the CFD4. And again, he made it as simple as possible, but this is another example of those forms that you can show to the aides in your office with which they will be very impressed. This will convince them that, yes, we really have thought of everything, and we've really, really brought down the difficulty of the regulatory side after this is all implemented. So this annual reconciliation, I think I went over a lot of this, but the monthly dividend payments might not be correct for some residents. Reasons why it might not be correct is if you have a birth, if you have an adoption, there's other changes in dependents. Maybe there's a divorce and the child has to live with one parent. The other parent can't claim that child, for example. The reconciliation of discrepancies would be handled at the end of the tax year, is his recommendation. And only residents with discrepancies would complete a form comparing entitlements with actual dividend payments. So this is those extra two. So it's only if there is a discrepancy, if you're owed more, that you would have to fill out one of these forms. And the completed form would be attached to the tax return for filers or the next year's claim for carbon fee and dividend for non-filers. That's the CFD1, which I showed you earlier. Now, the form of payment, there are three routes, which Alan dives into: bank deposit via electronic funds transfer, federal debit card account, and a paper check. So based on how many people use direct deposits currently, those who are income tax filers who are owed, it's estimated that 92.3% of households, 92% of households already have a bank account, which they can use for electronic funds transfer. Now, the problem with that, which some of you may be thinking, is that those who don't have a bank account are usually the lower income ones, those who most need the dividend. Well, a lot of those already have some sort of debit card for paying for stuff through some other government program. So they could be issued another debit card. It wouldn't be that different for them. They would be familiar with such a device. Or they could, it could be a new debit card, or they could top up their existing debit cards. Paper checks would only be issued as a backup. So, and most often if somebody moved, if there was a change of address, or loss of bank account is most frequently associated with moving or a loss of employment. Change of employment. So that would cause a paper check, and that of course would delay the dividend. But we think we can do this most often with electronic funds transfer. That reduces the amount of paper, the amount of expense, the potential for things to get lost, so the amount of inquiries for people not getting what they're owed. Now, taxability and other questions. So these are some of the, we're getting more into the weeds. So that was the 10 steps. That's what you can share with your offices. And again, it's my experience that offices are just, they're wowed. They are awestruck when we show them this report. It's been pretty consistent for me. So taxability. So the issues here, we're working under some constraints. Number one, we want to maximize carbon dividends to households. But number two, there is a revenue neutrality provision under the Pay-As-You-Go Act of 2010. Now, Congress has said that Congress can say, and we have a laser talk going through this thinking on our website, but Congress has said, you know, with everything, every law that is passed has to be revenue neutral. Revenue neutral means it neither increases nor decreases the deficit. Now, I know a lot of people have misconceptions. This is another misconception that people had actually going into Alan's talk, which didn't help. You know, revenue neutral, I think that a lot of people in CCL say revenue neutral means all the money goes back to households. And that's an implication, you know, that's an interpretation, but it's not the textbook definition. The textbook definition is that you neither increase nor decrease the deficit over 10 years. And so that laser talk goes into why that is, but basically the dividend has to be taxable for that to happen, so that's the problem here, and the impact on low income dependent federal programs is another consideration, and this was something that really shocked people in the presentation. Alan put up an example. Where a couple of grandparents who were taking care of a couple of children, they actually lost a little bit more than 100% of the value of the dividend because they were bumped up to another level in terms of means testing. So they actually got zero benefit and actually a little negative benefit from receiving the dividend. Now, the first time that Alan told me this was possible, I said, oh my goodness, is there any way we can fix this? And Alan said, yes, you can keep the dividend taxable, and that addresses the Pay-As-You-Go Act of 2010, but you make that exempt from means-tested programs. And I said, yes, let's do that. So if you read the FAQ, you'll find that that is CCL's official policy, that the dividend is taxable, and we avoid most of those scare stories, which Alan was highlighting for me to make me aware that this would happen. So by making the dividend taxable, but not for means-tested programs, we make sure that the impact on income-dependent federal programs is minimized. However, Alan was also saying we don't avoid all of that. And there's just no way around that. If you want to give people more money, there are pre-existing cutoffs that are really cliffs in the federal tax code and with these programs that people depend on. If you're going to give people more money, some people are going to, they're going to be earning more money and they're going to trip one of those over one of those cliffs. So that's just something that we should be aware of. We should prepare ourselves for. We've done everything we possibly can to minimize the number of cases where that is the case. Again, the dividend is not included as income for those means-tested programs. But we should go in with eyes wide open that because of the tax code, we're not going to avoid all of those situations. So there's a tension between our promise to maximize payments to households and the need to pass Congress, and the CBO scoring will be key. Some other questions that Alan goes through, these are the questions that aides didn't even know they had, and we didn't even know we had. Alan estimates that you could get this whole thing up and running within about 3 months, partially. So you could get dividend checks to, for example, about a third of the population, and you just do a different third of the population every other month. But to get everybody on a monthly basis, he thinks that would take 2 years, based on his long experience in implementing these programs. I kind of covered this earlier. A household, this is conforms with the tax filing definition. So if you, for example, have multiple families, multiple generations living in one household, every adult would be eligible for a full dividend, but it's the tax filing definition. So if you have two families living in one house and they both file different income taxes forms, each of those different income tax forms would be two separate households, even though they're living under the same roof. Would it be good to combine this with other payments? Alan goes through this and he highlights this would probably be bad optics. Part of the longevity that we're betting on with this, with returning all the revenue, is that people actually see the dividend. And if you are combining with other payments, they don't really see the dividend. They just see it as, well, my Social Security check is a bit bigger this month. And that may actually be more expensive. A lot of the expense comes up in how many inquiries there are So we're with inconsistencies. And if you're combining payments, was the inconsistency due to the Social Security check or was it due to the dividend? And if you have to go through and untangle that, it just makes it more complicated, and that will actually increase the administrative expenses. And again, how would the dividend actually be dispersed? In the vast majority of cases, electronic transfer, so no paper, debit card for those who don't have bank accounts, and then paper checks, most often issued when there's a loss of employment and a change of address. So what are the costs? This is something that people ask a lot about. The major one-time costs are developing the systems and software, the procedures, recruiting and hiring staff. Those are the one-time costs. The major ongoing costs would be paying those employees, paying for office space, communications equipment, and record keeping. Again, one of the biggest expenses is going to be how many times people are calling to correct errors. So really reducing those errors is important. And that's those transaction-related costs. Handling inquiries and resolving errors depends on the complexity of the problem and the employee time to resolve. The frequency of payments is not closely associated with costs. So actually, if you were to do an annual dividend, that actually might increase the number of inquiries, and it might actually increase the costs because people would, quote unquote, forget how much they're owed. Whereas if they're getting a monthly dividend, it's the same amount for a year, it's actually less likely that people will have an inquiry. So it was counterintuitive for me, but it might be that more frequent dividends, monthly dividends, as CCL has always been proposing, might actually be lower cost than less frequent dividends. And another thing, when you express the cost, some people have gotten sticker shock at the cost, which Alan estimated. That was not the main purpose of his study. And he was extremely conservative in doing that. And that goes back to the dependence that he wants to, I try to give our researchers. But when you divide that by the total amount of revenue, it drops off very quickly. And you're getting down to around 1% operating costs long-term. So that's very manageable. That's actually quite good for a federal program. And if you want to get more into our estimate, if you could go back for a second, Brett, there's a link to our laser talk, our administrative cost laser talk. That's Rick Knight, one of our research coordinators, going into depth as to what the cost might be, what other programs that are similar. And he comes up with a smaller number than Alan did in this point. And again, Alan was deliberately vague because that was not the main point of this study. Other questions that Alan addressed, changing eligibility. That question about 19. There's also, he talks about if you go 25, when students, usually college students, when do they really go on their own? When can you not claim them as a dependent, as a parent? Those reconciliations. He talks about a potential marriage penalty. Because we do limit it to two children per household, down the line as the dividend gets larger, there may be a disincentive to get married. And are we comfortable with that? What do we do with incarcerated residents? We provide a recommendation there. Americans living overseas. What about Americans who are filing taxes domestically, but they spend 9 months out of the year overseas? How much of the dividend should they get? That was not something I'd ever thought about until Alan brought it up. What about self-supporting minors? There aren't that many of them. There are people under 19 who are on their own. Shouldn't they be entitled to a full dividend? Well, our answer was yes, they should. And again, that's in our FAQ. And then what about local governments and agencies? That is a continual sticking point. There's not a great answer for that. If you make the dividend taxable, then that means that local governments can get some of that tax money. But there's a lot of states that don't have income tax. They don't have tax where they could collect some of that. And so you are going to get some local governments that are just going to, they're either going to have to change or they're going to have to raise taxes. There are going to have to be some uncomfortable decisions. But the climate's worth it, bottom line. And so that's a case that CCL volunteers have had to make. So to review some of the highlights, again, staffers didn't even think this was possible. And one of the strong conclusions here is that delivering the dividend to almost every American household is feasible. We can do this. So that's the main message that we want to pass on to staffers. And direct payment of the dividends to households is simpler, it's more stable, less burdensome than paying it indirectly through wages and or Social Security benefits. So this is an opportunity for you to educate your staffers. They will, 9 times out of 10, they will assume that reducing payroll taxes is simpler. And so this is an opportunity for you to talk them through why that is not the case. Important details like the forms to apply for the dividend, specify tax withholding, and reconcile status changes are fully worked out. And again, staffers who have shown this too, they've been just awed by the work that Alan did here. And more than 95% of dividends can be paid by direct bank deposit funds added to government-issued debit cards, which should keep costs low. And the impacts of several variations to key policy provisions are analyzed for the pros and cons. So we just have it all out there. It's all transparent. This report should be a tool for legislators to identify problems and make decisions. I think it will be most useful for regulators on the backside, but the more light we can shine on this for legislators, the more comfortable they're going to be actually signing on, introducing, and ultimately passing this. And this study does a ton of that. And this is, like I said, it's been a top four issue for legislators every single year I've done that June analysis. And again, so just as I said, Alan left people with more misconceptions than they came in with in his talk. And so just to reiterate what those were, the most common ones that I got, and to explain, the payroll tax was not an option that CCL considered. That was something that Alan wanted to consider. And I do think it's super useful because that is a bias that most economists and most staffers do have. So now we can have one of their own, somebody very detailed, extensive knowledge in this field, coming to the conclusion that no, dividends, direct monthly dividends are the best case. A lot of people in our organization had misconceptions about what revenue neutrality really was, and it is neither increasing nor decreasing the deficit over 10 years, and the implications of taxation of the dividend. So a lot of people think that if you make the dividend taxable, you're actually hurting the poor, but you're actually helping the poor by making the dividend taxable. These last two are intertwined. So what the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, assumes, not just for this, but for all similar policies, is that if you raise money in one place, it's tied up, and the government will lose tax revenue from other places. So for example, if you raise $100 billion, the government will assume, the CBO will assume, that they're going to get less money, $25 billion, 25% of $100 billion is $25 billion, less somewhere down the line, either from reduced investments and taxes they would collect on those investments, reduced payroll. They're not hiring as many people, and the government collects payroll taxes on those. They just assume that they're going to get less money, 25% less revenue through that. So if you raise $100 billion from the fee, CBO will say the government is actually only getting $75 billion. But if you return $100 billion, 75 minus 100 is minus 25. The CBO will say that this is revenue negative. It is actually increasing the deficit over 10 years. That's what the CBO will say. And so, but they also say, we found publications and they are cited in Alan's report, if you make the dividend taxable, the CBO will assume it's revenue neutral. The CBO will assume that you recover that $25 billion in income taxes from households. And so that's important. And because the income tax schedule is progressive, the poor pay less than the rich. If you do this, that means that the poor are going to get more. So for example, if the poor get a dollar, then they're going to keep that dollar. Another way of dealing with the CBO offset, and again, there's a laser talk on this. Another way of dealing with is if you, instead of you raise $100 billion, the government just keeps $25 billion, and then we return $75 billion as dividends. That's actually the way that the Curbelo-Fitzpatrick bill, which was recently introduced, that's what they do. They just keep 25% of the revenue for the government. Problem with that is one of those bottom 20%, in the first scenario where the dividend is taxable, they get a dollar back. In that second scenario, if we were to do that, you're only getting 75 cents back. And so it is possible that the the Congress could say PAYGO doesn't matter. We can just discount this, but we don't think that's likely to pass because we're talking about pretty big deficits over the lifespan of this policy. We just don't think they'd be willing to increase the deficit that much. So we're left with either taking that 25% off on the front end, which is going to be worse for the poor, or taking it off on the back end, which is actually going to be better for the poor. And so we chose the option that was better for the poor. That was CCL's thinking with the constraints we had. So that's what I have. So now I'm sure there are many questions because this is complicated stuff. So let's hear them.
To your question, Tim asks this one about attending the presentations, the second one that Alan gave on Monday. And this was specifically kind of demonstrated through that grandparents example who ended up owing a little bit more. They wrote two questions that follow from that. One is that particular situation addressed by setting aside means testing? And two, how likely is it that someone will still be adversely affected given that some will? Is that an odds of 1 out of 1,000 per se? How often are we talking about?
It is rare. I don't actually have a good sense of how rare it is, but it is rare. Again, you know, Alan first highlighted this for me and I said, how do we fix this? And he said, you make the dividend exempt from means testing programs and that gets most of them. That does get most of them. So this is going to be a very rare situation. But there are going to be cases. And so I actually had a misconception. I asked Alan to fix this. I thought he fixed this. I thought in that presentation that he was giving that as an example of something that we avoided by doing that. But he was saying this will still happen. And I was able to clarify that with Alan afterwards. So it is a rare situation, but it's not going to be zero. And we're just going to have to be aware that there are going to be situations like the one he highlighted. They're going to be infrequent. And we're going to have to say, you know, there's anytime you give people more money, because there are these cliffs embedded within the American tax system, which existed before CCL ever came, was a twinkling in Marshall's eye. You would have to fix those. You would have to fix those cliffs in the tax system. So anyway, that's what I know there. I wish I had a better answer. I wish we could get rid of this. But again, we're not. It's not our role. We don't see it as part of as being useful to shy away from uncomfortable truths. And this I'm sure for me comes as my background as a scientist. If you've got a bias, you charge right at it. You figure it out, and if it's uncomfortable, you tell yourself that uncomfortable truth, and you make it part of the story. And that's the most honest and transparent thing that we can do.
No, appreciate the upfront honesty. Tim and Susie say it is complex, and thank you. Here's another one that was privately chatted me here. So speaking of the dividend delivery and the amount of households protected, there are various studies out there, even at CCL sites, that are, you know, different, 2/3, 53%, 70%, you know, depending on the source, household impact, office of treasury analysis, all that. What is the best estimate and why, in your opinion?
Use whatever you want as long as you cite it. Household impact study is super useful because if you give that estimate, first of all, it's rock bottom. And the reason that is rock bottom is because Kevin Ummel, who did that report, assumed 100% pass-through of costs. So he assumed that 100% of the costs of the fee were being passed on to consumers. In reality, about 13% of that is going to be eaten by companies. So that means people are getting the same dividend, but costs are going to be 13% lower. And so you're actually going to see a lot more people benefit. And so again, that falls under Kevin's discretion as a researcher, but that is a rock bottom estimate. As a scientist, I feel good about citing conservative numbers, and I feel good in saying that this is a rock bottom number. It's going to be higher. The Treasury study says, which was released at the beginning of 2017, it doesn't say 70%. That is commonly cited. It does not say that. It says that the mean of the bottom 7 deciles will end up ahead. Now, if you look at the same graph in Kevin's report, you would assume that 60% of households benefit. And so the Treasury study could have been 65%, it could have been 63%, it could have been 77%. they don't specify. So 70% is inaccurate. What is accurate is the mean of the bottom seven deciles end up ahead. That is accurate, according to that study. So, just pay attention to what they're actually reporting. Cite your source. It depends on what you want to do. It's going to be hard to get a better source than the Office of Tax Analysis, which produced that report, which is, by the way, again, that's where Allen was for 42 years, the Office of Tax Analysis. So, it's all good stuff. As long as you cite it, I think you're going to be fine.
Excellent. First, a huge round of applause for just obviously taking the time and really walking us through with such depth tonight, Danny. Really appreciate the insights that you've helped all of us gain a deeper appreciation for. And here is the link to where the actual lesson will be. I put this as well as our emails in the chat window for anyone that has follow-up questions. But we always love closing by just thanking all of you for making the difference. And we really appreciate everyone tuning in to help clarify and charge at their own biases or understandings, as Danny is so aptly put here, to understand. Everyone, all lines will be unmuted. Have a great night, everyone. So
thank you so much. Thank you.
All right. Very helpful. Later. Thanks, Danny.
Of course.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time and attention.
Thanks everyone.